This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The window is closing. The dire but not unexpected warning from the United Nations in a new report on climate change. It finds that we residents of Earth have already heated the planet by 2 degrees Fahrenheit, and that no matter what actions we take, a hotter, more turbulent climate future is here. Still, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports there's still a chance to change our emissions to stop tomorrow from being even hotter. How would we do that? What does a hotter reality mean for us here in Greater Boston, and how do we live with it? To help us answer those questions, we turn to Peter Frumhoff. He's the Director of Science and Policy and Chief Climate Scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, a Cambridge-based nonprofit. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
A pleasure to join you.
So I'm struck that you were a lead author on a previous IPCC report. So you're just the person to kind of paint the picture for us here, because the data is a little overwhelming. What does this report say?
Well, there's no way to sugarcoat it. I mean, it is a stark and sober appraisal of the state of the science. And the state of the science is clear. We are already living in a globally warmed world. We've already had, as you say, 2 degrees Fahrenheit warming, and that's bringing with it changes that we're already seeing in our lived experience, from more extreme heat, such as we're seeing in the Pacific Northwest, literally as we speak, to wildfires in the West and across the globe, to more intense flooding and droughts. And these are changes that are a consequence of our continued burning of fossil fuels and emissions associated with it, of carbon dioxide, a primary heat-trapping gas that is increasing warming across the planet.
And as I understand it, Peter, this report really says those emissions are a cause for the change in temperature. And also, maybe for the first time, we have some greater certainty about that contribution to weather patterns as well, correct?
That's right. The extreme weather events that we're seeing now are supercharged. They're supercharged by the warming that's resulted from our emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases. The report highlights how we're seeing more extreme events, from increased flooding and droughts to more extreme heat, literally in every region of the globe. This is not something that anybody is being spared from. And those changes are real. They're present tense. They're caused very clearly, as the report highlights, in its sober and kind of scientifically understated tones, by our actions, by the burning of fossil fuels. It also importantly paints a picture of future worlds. It provides, through climate models, some clarity, increased clarity, about the possible different futures that we may live in, depending on the choices that we make today. So it's both stark but clear in its recognition that the future climate needn't be much worse if we take serious action, or could be quite catastrophic if we continue on the path that we're currently on.
All right, let's dispatch with this next question right now. How credible are these findings, and what weight does the organization itself, IPCC, bring to those findings?
So the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has been around for about 40 years. It's the global organization that brings the scientific community together literally every 6 to 7 years to do a state of the science assessment under the auspices of the United Nations. The report could not be more conservative and careful in its approach. They have a set of standards. They only rely on the peer-reviewed literature. This is the first of a series of reports that will come out over the next several months. This looks just at the physical science evidence. What is the physical science telling us about the changes we're seeing and the changes that are projected? It reviews the peer-reviewed literature. It itself is subject to multiple rounds of reviews. It's several hundred scientists from across the globe participating in a process. Every government who's a member of the United Nations, including the United States, literally has to sign off word by word, line by line, comma by semicolon, to the summary for policymakers, the core document that speaks the findings of the science in clear and unequivocal terms to the policymakers, who are the primary audience, together with the public at large.
So there's so much I want to unpack there, but let's begin by just bringing this home for people a little bit. So you talked about extreme weather events. We're hearing from this report that We have a global scale, global problem, and the weather extremities are going to get worse. Last year, hottest summer on record in Massachusetts. This year, we've seen one of the wettest Julys on record. The heat waves in June made it the hottest June on record. This report says, what, these are new realities? This is more of the shape of thing to come, regardless of which of these scenarios plays out, right?
Well, it's definitely clear that we are seeing disruptive climate change today here in New England and across the Northeast and literally across the globe. And so we've had a record over the past couple of decades of, for example, increased heavy precipitation in the Northeast and New England. We've seen rainfall and snow come in more intense packets, and that has lots of implications for flooding. That trajectory is already with us. It's already caused by the warming of the planet, is worsened by that. And so we are living and will continue to live in a warmed world. The question at hand is really how much worse will it get? And what can we do to both prepare for the changes that we know are coming, increased sea level rise, for example, something we might want to chat about, but also quite clearly by taking strong action to reduce emissions. Avoid truly catastrophic changes. So yes, we have some warming today. We're seeing it in real time. It's part of our lived experience. But if we take serious action to reduce emissions, the IPCC report is quite clear that we can transition to a clean energy economy and one that limits the amount of warming further by just a couple fractions of a degree. We'll see some further impacts associated with that. But they won't be ones that we can't handle, but they would be truly ones we can't handle as a society, both here in the Northeast and across the world, if we continue our current practice of treating the atmosphere as an open sewer and sending unfettered carbon dioxide emissions to it. That has to change.
Okay, obviously this is a global problem and we'll need global policy change, but we are here in the Northeast. This show is Radio Boston and you've been talking about the Northeast. So let's stay here for a minute. You said we could take steps to reduce emissions. We could take steps that don't bring us into the worst of the five types of scenarios that are laid out for what could come next. Let's just touch on what some of those policy changes here might be.
So there are many things we can do here to prepare for changes, and that includes making our communities and our coastlines more resilient, for example, to sea level rise. We'll see about another 6 to 12 inches of sea level rise globally and presumably across the Northeast as well by mid-century under the best of circumstances.
That's basically guaranteed, right?
I beg your pardon?
That's basically guaranteed under all the circumstances. Yeah, we'll see at least that much.
Pretty much baked into the climate already, the changes that we're seeing as the ocean continues to warm and expand and as land-based ice melts into it, is some further expansion of sea level rise. And the best estimate from the IPCC report is that we'll see about another 6 to 12 inches globally and on average, including across the Northeast. That's significant, right? A storm surge that comes from a nor'easter would have greater impact if it came a few decades hence than if it came today. These are things we need to prepare for to limit coastal flooding. We need to make sure our communities and those most vulnerable among us are prepared. But here in the Northeast and across the nation, we can take aggressive action to reduce emissions. There are obviously choices we can make as individuals to transition to cleaner burning cars or to use public transportation instead of automobiles and reduce pollutants that way. There are lots of individual choices. The most important thing we can do, though, is make sure that our national policymakers, both the Biden administration and Congress, are taking action to set national policies to bring our emissions, as the president has argued for, has proposed, down about 50% by 2030 over the next decade. That's a step towards the net zero emissions we need by mid-century. And that requires really national policies to build out charging infrastructure for electric cars, to raise the fuel economy standards of our vehicles so they're less polluting, to require that new homes and buildings have codes that don't rely on natural gas, but rather on electricity, which you can make much cleaner by cleaning up the electrical grid, by setting clean energy standards and transitioning really a sharp turn away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy from wind and solar, all of which provide lots of economic opportunities as well as climatic and societal benefits in terms of limiting climate risk. So these are things that require our action at a national level and that all of us in New England can call upon our national policymakers to support.
And I do want to note that we have a new law here in the Commonwealth that the state has to achieve its own net zero emissions by 2050. And for our listeners, net zero means total amount of greenhouse gases that we put into the atmosphere have to be balanced by what we can remove. So we do have that policy in place here. I wonder about other kinds of mitigation. I'm thinking, Peter, of the reporting on the city of Chelsea, which is one of the hottest cities in the state. You talked about protecting our most vulnerable. It has vulnerable populations. White roofs on the school buildings to reduce surface heat. Will we see more practical everyday steps like that that we're all going to need to take to mitigate the 1.5 degrees of warming that this report says is going to happen now, no matter what?
There are lots of things we can do at a local level. White roofs is one, planting trees in urban areas to increase, to reduce what's called the heat island effect and make our city streets, particularly in hard-hit urban areas, cooler. Those are actions that we can take at a local level. Local communities can set building codes and require increased electricity generation as opposed to oil and gas. They can provide subsidies for communities to transition from oil and gas heating in the winter to heat pump. Something I've done personally has been a tremendous benefit to both my electricity costs and to my climate impacts. So there's lots of things that local communities can do. As you rightly point out, the state can take action, but we all have to put our shoulder to the wheel and make sure that our national government, both the administration and Congress, are acting in alignment with the science that this report so clearly and starkly portrays.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to kind of get personal. When our team was talking about this morning and just looking at the data and the messaging of this report, it gets you in your stomach. You have worked in this area for a very long time. You've written one of these reports before. How did you feel as a citizen of Earth when you saw this?
You know, I can read the report as a scientist, and I understand and I'm familiar with the literature, and I can read its facts in a straightforward and rational way. But as you say, it's impossible to read this to really recognize what it's describing in those kind of sober scientific terms without tearing up, without recognizing that this is a real gut punch, right? It is. It describes a world that we may well go into if we don't take actions literally today, that will be unrecognizable to those of us living today, and one that we do not want to provide our children and grandchildren. It is a heartbreaking story of what we might have done had we taken action according to the science 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago, had the fossil fuel industry not invested in denial and delay. But we only can act from where we are today. And so I am both heartbroken and determined to make sure that we move forward and make the sharp turn away from fossil fuels that we need and leave a hospitable planet for our kids.
All right, so give us one glimmer of hope. What's one of the hopeful things for you?
Well, I'm cognizant of the strong policy position of the current administration. I don't want to get too political, but the current presidential administration has taken a very strong stand, making a commitment to bring emissions down 50% this nation over the next decade and to return to the Paris Climate Agreement and be a meaningful leader. It's going to take more than the administration, though. It's going to take Congress. And I'm very heartened by the leadership by our members of Congress here in Massachusetts and by and large across New England, both in the Senate and the House. They are ones who get this. They are ones who are willing to work on a bipartisan basis. And I think all of us need to speak to our friends and families in other parts of the country and make sure that they're also speaking to their policymakers and telling them what they need to see done so that we can all make it through this truly challenging climate crisis.
All right, that's Peter Frumhoff. He's the Director of Science and Policy and Chief Climate Scientist at the nonprofit Union of Concerned Scientists in Cambridge. He also served as a lead author on a past IPCC report on climate change. Peter, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
As we speak, lawmakers are putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle. You see, after every census, we redraw the lines for our precincts and districts. And how those lines get drawn can be critical for representation and for who gets elected. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley, for example, made history in the 7th Congressional District after the lines were redrawn. So communities usually draw their precincts first, the city-level boundaries. The problem is that that takes time, and the census data is late this year. So the legislature wants first crack to draw their districts first and is trying to pass a bill that would flip how we redistrict on its head. But some cities and towns and the Secretary of the Commonwealth are pushing back. So with me now to talk about where we stand now in this redistricting process, what the fight is about, is Emma Platoff. She is a reporter with the Boston Globe. Also joining us, Beth Huang. She is the director of the group Massachusetts Voter Table and convenes the organization Drawing Democracy Coalition, which assists in public outreach on redistricting. Emma and Beth, great to have you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you. Emma, I'm going to start with you. We're going to set this up a little bit. This can sound so dry, redistricting, Emma, but it's a big thing for democracy, and it's a big thing every 10 years. Define what it is and why the stakes are so high, actually.
It's a great question. You know, I think it's easy for people to see redistricting as a sort of boring process of equalizing district sizes. Okay, we have to make sure that Lori Trahan has the same number of people in her congressional district as Jim McGovern and questions like that. But it actually gets to a really fundamental tenet of American democracy, right? Which is the question of one person, one vote. We know that the way these maps are drawn has incredible implications for the people who are elected, how well and whether they represent the people in their districts. And so I always say that if you care about anything in government, if you care about climate change, you care about redistricting. If you care about criminal justice, you care about redistricting. If you care about public health or education or anything else, you should care about redistricting because the stakes are enormously high. The question here is whether your interests will be represented by the person you elect to the state house or to Congress.
Okay, so with those stakes in order now, Massachusetts usually redistricts precincts in the city level first, then goes to state and federal districts. That's different from most states. Why do we do it that way, and why is that potentially a problem this year? Emma.
So the problem this year has been the data delays of the census. And that's a problem in every state across the country. You know, lawmakers are having to sort of scramble to draw these lines faster than they otherwise would. The question here with precincts or districts first, it's just kind of, if you can imagine building something with Legos, which I actually think may be Beth's analogy that I'll borrow. Do you want to start with smaller building blocks and build it into something larger? So start with these voting precincts and build them into a state house district? Or would you rather start with something bigger and then subdivide it up into smaller equal size pieces? And this year, state lawmakers want to do the districts first. This is actually something they've been talking about doing for a long time, getting in line with the way that most other states do it. And the question is whether that will happen. We know that lawmakers in the state house and in the state Senate, Democrats dominate both chambers, have both demonstrated that they want to do this, but we're just waiting for that bill to get across the finish line.
So thank you, Emma. I'm going to turn to you, Beth, because to use Emma's analogy, which I think was originally your analogy, if we look at these Legos, sounds like you're advocating to take the building, the big thing first, and break it up. Why? Why are you advocating for that? And why does it even matter which thing we do first?
That's a great question. I think it comes down to who has first mover's advantage. And honestly, most years, the Drawing Democracy Coalition doesn't have a stance on this. However, this year, because of the 4.5-month delay in the release of data, as Emma alluded to earlier, we want to make sure that there is adequate time to meet important deadlines. So there is a residency requirement in the Constitution that state representatives need to live in the district to which they're elected for at least 1 year before the upcoming election. So the 2022 election, mark your calendars now, is November 8th, 2022. That means that the deadline for redistricting or drawing House districts at the very least is November 8th of 2021. That is a firm constitutional deadline that we cannot miss. However, there is no constitutional deadline for drawing precincts. And so if we want to give ample time for drawing districts, and very importantly, getting public input on those districts, we need to draw the districts first. If we tried to draw the precincts and the districts, or draw the precincts first and then the districts, we're really cutting into the amount of time that the public has to give comment on these districts before the constitutional deadline on November 8th.
Okay, so basically, cities used to get to go first. Normally, you would support that too, but given the time frame here, the state stuff has to be done in time for everybody to live in the district they want to run in for a year. But the cities are not against the same constitutionally limited deadline. So you're saying that there's room on the back end, so let's flip it, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so that on one hand, a listener might say, okay, well then, why are we even having this conversation? Why not just flip it? And that's where I want to introduce some sound from Secretary Galvin, who has come out against this flipping idea. Here he is making his argument on Channel 5 about why not to do that earlier this summer.
The issue here is not simply a bureaucratic one. The issue is defining communities within a community. In other words, defining neighborhoods, defining various sections of towns. For town governments, oftentimes the town meeting members are directed by this. In cities, it's the city councilors. They should have the right to define the political districts within their own community, and then the legislature use those to draw the larger districts. People are losing sight of the fact that I think the issue when it comes to redistricting or any kind of thing, it's not about candidates. It's not about campaigns. It's about communities and voters.
So Emma, as a journalist, bring us a case example. What goes wrong or doesn't work right or is a problem for a city? I've read concerns in, you know, Peabody, for example, but pick an example and illustrate for us what goes wrong according to the Galvin argument here.
Well, I think what Secretary Galvin is arguing is that local officials know their communities best, right? They might know that actually this is a block and this is a neighborhood where there are a lot of immigrants, and it would make sense for them to be grouped together in a voting precinct and ultimately in any district. I think the counter argument that you would hear from state lawmakers who are on the other side of this is, hey, we know these communities well, too. You know, state house districts are not that big. State senate districts are not that big. We know these numbers block by block. We're going to have this really detailed census data, and we will make the same wise decisions when we draw our districts that our local officials could make from knowing the maps better.
So I have read arguments, for example, however, that one might have to vote in two different places, in two different precincts, one for local elections, one for statewide elections, that people might be confused as their precincts change because precincts weren't drawn first and that could suppress the vote. What about those kinds of arguments, Beth?
Look, the major point that I agree with Secretary Galvin on is that this is about communities and it's about voters. We think that moving redistricting before reprecincting will empower voters to know their electoral districts as soon as possible and empower municipalities by providing adequate time to draw the precincts. We strongly believe and have faith in our elections officials and city clerks to be able to draw the precincts, knowing that they will have an additional constraint of the district lines already being drawn. However, towns and cities, one, will be able to still draw the precinct lines to avoid the type of voter confusion. And second, cities and towns have plenty of opportunities to weigh in on what are the neighborhoods and the communities of interest in their municipalities. Ordinary people have as well. The Drawing Democracy Coalition has received over 177 submissions of neighborhood maps from residents across the state. And we strongly believe that we need to empower voters as much as possible, decrease the amount of confusion, ensuring that voters know what district that they live in earlier is much more important than what precinct they live in, which people think of close to election day.
So, Emma, I want to note Secretary Galvin wasn't available to join us today. He's getting ready for the first round of release of census information on Thursday. Give us a sneak preview. What do you think we're expecting to learn on Thursday?
We're going to learn a lot on Thursday. There are estimates, there are informal numbers that show us a few things. One is that the state, the population of Western Massachusetts is shrinking, and that starts to have implications for those districts, right? If you're a congressman who represents Western Massachusetts, does your district have to start creeping a little bit, right, towards the east? We expect that those numbers have gone down. We don't know by how much, and that math is going to be pivotal. The other thing we expect is that the white population of Massachusetts is shrinking and the state is becoming more diverse. And that is going to have major implications for the number of the technical term in redistricting is majority-minority districts that can be drawn. So communities, populations where people of color, you know, are more than 50% of a district. We expect that lawmakers will and should draw more of those districts based on the changes in the population so far. We don't know exactly how many. We don't know exactly where. And so these are the details that will be filled out Thursday once we get this really granular data.
So, Beth, at the very top, we talked about the state's 7th Congressional District and how that is now represented by Ayanna Pressley, who made history in getting elected there. We just heard Emma talk about the likelihood of more majority-minority districts based on the census information. Do you see potential in redistricting here to dramatically or even somewhat change who represents whom in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts going forward?
I think we have a lot of opportunities across the Commonwealth. In 2011, the Drawing Democracy Coalition increased the number of majority-minority districts from just 10 in the House to 20, and that has created many opportunities for communities of color to elect candidates of their own choice. We are looking to do the same this year. In particular, we're looking at both the population of residents, but because communities of color tend to have younger residents and also tend to have non-citizens, we also are looking at who are eligible voters and who makes up these districts. You can have a district that is, let's say, 60% residents of color, but only 40% voters of color. And so we're really looking at the balance of power in these new majority-minority districts, since actually only 9 of the 20 majority-minority House districts are represented by people of color.
Okay, and Emma, briefly, you sort of set a clock for us in the background. I can hear it tick, 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 right? We got to hit some things by November 8th in order for there to achieve constitutional requirements and make sure there's a year of running for a race next year in 2022. Any chance that under any of these scenarios that we just miss the clock?
I think state lawmakers are not planning to miss the deadline on this, though we know that on Beacon Hill, deadlines are sometimes treated a little bit more like suggestions. November 8th is what I'm hearing where people are aiming for on this. The congressional districts don't face that same deadline. They may come a little bit later. I would expect it to be days or weeks later, not months later. But so far, that's what they're aiming for. And hey, fingers crossed.
All right, that's Emma Platoff. She's a reporter with the Boston Globe. Also with us has been Beth Huang. She's the director of the group Massachusetts Voter Table and convenes Drawing Democracy Coalition, which assists in public outreach on redistricting. Thanks to both of you, Beth and Emma.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I just finished a book on Saturday. It was one of those you're just gone in while you are reading it. I think my family's actually glad it's over. But the problem is I'm going on vacation next week and I already binged my beach read. I think I may not be alone. It's August. We've got a few more weeks of summer left to enjoy. What to read? I need a new one and I bet you've got some recommendations. So we thought we'd take some time today to talk about that. What are you reading? What do you recommend to others? What can we recommend to you? What are you still hoping to get to? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or for your Twitterers out there, tweet us at Radio Boston with some suggestions. We've got a couple of great people to help us with this. Jennifer DeLeon, she's the author. She is an author and editor of Wise Latinas. And Rachel Cass, head buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge. Jennifer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Rachel, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Okay, Jennifer, before we dive into some specific books. I'm going to ask you, what kinds of books do you like to read, especially in the summertime?
Oh, it's such a great question. I love being immersed in memoir or a long novel, something that just kind of absorbs me. Like you were saying, you just want to take a deep dive into a good story. So those are the kinds that I gravitate towards.
And Rachel, same for you, memoir, long novel, or do you like something different in the summer?
I love a long novel in the summer. I try and use the summer to catch up on things I haven't had time to read during busier parts of the year. So I do find myself reading nonfiction and all sorts of other things. But a big, juicy, meaty literary novel is sort of my favorite thing to read on vacation.
All right. So we all like, because, you know, I like the big ones in the summertime, too, where it feels like you've got a little more room to stretch out and read. Jennifer, we're going to do lists in a minute, but I did notice you said you like memoirs. Three of the books on your list are memoirs. What is it about a memoir that you love and that you particularly love in these warm, sort of leisurely or more leisurely, hopefully, summer months?
Right. I mean, again, it's like what you said, there's a little bit more time to stretch. And, you know, I just came back from a week on the Cape and I had long conversations. I was able to tell stories, listen to stories. It just feels like there's more room in your heart and in your head. And so memoirs are true stories, but I think the best memoirs read like novels, actually. And so you kind of get two for one. And I love learning about people's lives and feeling like I have a front row seat to their secrets and all of their vulnerabilities, but also the humor. So that's always why I've been drawn to memoir.
Okay, I'm going to turn to the phones in a minute, but let me just put the number out. Call us with your recommendations. What types of books do you like to read in the summer? What are you reading now? What do you set off for that next long read? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or tweet us at Radio Boston. Rachel, you're a bookstore buyer. And I mean, everything, it feels like, has changed in the last 18 months or so. Is what people want to read changing as well?
Absolutely. We saw a lot of changes in what people were buying over the course of 2020 and into 2021. Now we're halfway done with 2021 already. Last summer, when we reopened after being closed, was right at the moment where the Black Lives Matter protests were really capturing the news cycle. And we saw a lot of people trying to read up on those issues. And we're seeing that continue into this summer. We've also seen a lot of self-care happening, and it was an extremely challenging year, and it continues to be sort of very challenging to exist in the world right now. So we're seeing a lot of sort of escapist fiction. We've actually been seeing adult coloring books make a comeback a little bit. And clearly people sort of trying to take a break from everything that's happening in the world. So we're sort of seeing both ends of that.
All right, I think we're going to start some lists and suggestions now, and I'll go to the phones to kick us off, 800-423-8255. We've got Susan on the line in Leominster. Susan, what you got for us?
Hi. Yes. I read one book by Mr. Chris Gardner, G-A-R-D-N-E-R. It's the one, Permission to Dream. It's the one that they made the movie with Will Smith and his son, and I have his other book that I'm reading. It's lessons on how to go from, people that are homeless, or, you know, losing jobs, and how to go from there moving forward to a better life. And that one start from where you are.
Great. Thank you, Susan. I appreciate that. Let's get another person here. We've got Cynthia. Cynthia, you are on the road calling from your car, yes?
I am. Yes, indeed.
So hopefully you're not reading right this second, Cynthia, but what are you reading when you're not in the car?
Well, currently I'm reading Kim Stanley Robinson's current book, The Ministry for the Future. It's a science fiction novel, but it's scary as all get out because it seems pretty prescient, but at the same time, it's also very hopeful. So I'm looking forward to an ending that maybe points in a good direction.
All right, we'll keep our fingers crossed for that. Cynthia, Jennifer, give us one from your list.
A novel that just debuted last week, or that was just launched, is called The President and the Frog by Carolina de Robertis. And she's a very accomplished novelist. And this one it's incredible. It's a story about the poorest president in the world, in South America. And he's being interviewed by a journalist at in his garden at home. And it goes back and forth between this interview and then a time he spent in isolation during a dictatorship when all the company he had in the cell was a frog. And he would have these conversations with the frog. And I know it sounds a little like, wow, what is this about? But it's such a gripping read, and it delves into serious topics, but it's also so funny and whimsical. And so it's kind of, I don't know, I think it's a great read for a long weekend where you kind of want both. You want to feel like you're reading something hefty, but you also want to be entertained. And it's just gorgeous.
All right, fabulous. I'm going to come to you in just a second, Rachel, but Dr. Regine Jean-Charles is tweeting at us. This conversation about reading at Radio Boston started with both guests saying a long read is their go-to for the summer. I agree. I've been getting lost in The Old Drift by At Namwalin, which I believe is Namwali Serpell. It is enthralling. So there you go, The Old Drift. How about you, Rachel? Pick one from your list.
The one on my list that's sort of the long, engrossing, century-spanning novel that I'm really loving recommending this summer is called Great Circle by Maggie Shipstead. And it follows a woman who, in the 30s and 40s, was trying to navigate around the world in an airplane. She was a pilot, and she was attempting to go around the world through both the North and the South Poles. And the novel follows her life and her journey from sort of rural Montana through being a pilot during World War II through this attempt. And she disappears on this attempt and sort of her legacy throughout the remaining century. And you find out she disappears at the very beginning. I'm not giving anything away. But it's just really engrossing and really, really a lot of fun, and really is about 20th century womanhood and ambition and desire. And I really loved it.
1-800-423-8255 to share book ideas with us. We've got Max on the line in Ipswich. What you reading, Max?
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. So I'm calling about my personal favorite book of all time, House of Leaves by Mark Z. Danielewski. I've talked to people and none of them seem to know it, but it's got layers of stories within each narrative. And if you want a book that really engages you and requires a bit of effort, I guess, to get into it, I absolutely recommend this book. It's certainly a bit scary, but I wouldn't call it a horror book. And I promise that this is not like any book that you've read before. It is completely unique, designed for the paper reading experience, I guess.
All right. House of Leaves. Thanks for that, Max. Let's pick up Rich, too, in Belmont. Rich, go ahead.
Hi. I love Tana French. She's an Irish-American author. She's written a bunch of books, and several of them are the Dublin Police Squad series. And my favorite is Faithful Place. It's a neighborhood in Dublin, and it goes through a couple of generations of really tough times, little Angela Ashes in the beginning. But all her books are great. And the thing I like most about her is that she writes men from the inside, women from the inside, and teenagers. So she captures them all. She's really fantastic. And I also would recommend her as an audience.
Oops, we lost. Sorry. Thanks for that, Rich. And actually, so that's a great thing to bring back to you, Jennifer. As a writer, who writes characters, you know, in some way that you just find, so compelling and makes for a great summer read?
Oh, I love this question. I mean, thinking about YA, that's where my brain jumps to as a YA author. My book, Don't Ask Me Where I'm From, it came out a year ago. It just came out in paperback. And so I'm drawn to, you know, the kind of voicey narration in YA. And another novel that I highly recommend is called Your Corner Dark. It's a YA novel set in Jamaica, and it's written by Desmond Hall, a local Boston author. And it follows a 16-year-old teenager named Frankie, and he's struggling to save his father, who's been admitted to the hospital, but all he has is his scholarship to college in the United States to use. And so he takes a big gamble. I won't tell you what happens, but it's a page turner. And I mean, that comes to mind when I think about strong characters. Teenagers often make poor decisions, which make for great conflicts on the page. And I love vulnerable, you know, funny narrators. I'm thinking of a memoir by Calvin Hennick, another local author who wrote a beautiful memoir called Once More to the Rodeo. And it follows his road trip that he took with his son, who at the time was 5. And he drove from Boston to Iowa to Calvin's hometown. And Calvin is white and his son is biracial. And it really raises these questions of how do you raise, you know, a son growing into a man? How do you raise a biracial son in the United States? What does that look like? What does that mean? And what does it mean to be a good father? It's just, I think over the long weekend, we spend time with family maybe. And so that's on my mind as well.
So I just want to take a second and note for listeners, we will have the list from Jennifer and Rachel on our website, and we'll try to capture some of these other titles for you as well and put them on our website at radioboston.org. So if you're like me and you're thinking, wait, I'm never going to remember all these, don't worry. We will have them for you on our website. Rachel, I want to come back to you. So we've been talking about all this great long fiction and these deep character builds. I was surprised when Chris Siderick, our producer, asked me what book I wanted to bring or books I wanted to bring to the table. My gut was that I wanted to bring Empire of Pain by Patrick Radden Keefe. We had him on the show. It's a nonfiction book, a devastating look at the Sackler family, their role in the opioid epidemic. And I was just so surprised, but there was a meat to it and a sprawling 100-year history. And also, I felt like I was learning something incredibly important about my own community and the world around me. Can we find these great nonfiction books that still work on the beach? And do you have any? I know you brought a couple of nonfictions on your list.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, like I said, I sometimes find the summer to be a great time to catch up on things that I maybe didn't have time to read the rest of the year. And yes, I like to be engrossed in a long novel, but I also like to have the time to really think deeply about something that I'm reading. One of the books that I read earlier this summer was How the Word is Passed by Clint Smith, which looks into sort of the ways that we memorialize slavery and the slave trade in the United States. And one of the places that he goes is abroad as well. But each chapter, he goes to a different place that had some connection to the historic slave trade in the United States and looks at what is there now and how we think about it and how we remember it and how we talk about it and how we teach it and maybe how we misremember it. And it's really a personal book because it's sort of a travelogue, and it's a lot of it is about these personal conversations he has with curators and tour guides and fellow travelers, fellow visitors at these places. But he also really digs into the history, and it's sort of a survey of the history of each of those places and that time. So there's really a lot of meat to it, but it is also very lyrical and beautiful and personal. And it was a perfect thing to read during the summer because I felt like I had the time to read it sort of slowly and to think about it and to be reflective about it. So I think the summer is great for that as well.
Let's go back to the phones here, 800-423-8255, to make your recommendations. Or in the case of Danny in Medford, I think ask for a recommendation. That's what you're looking for, right, Danny?
Thank you so much for taking my call, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate this conversation. I was wondering, you know, I have a preschooler at home, and this summer in particular, with so many kids at home, not taking part in as many camps or different programs, you know, I'm looking for different books that are engaging for emergent readers and for kids that are, you know, kind of beyond board books or kind of starting elementary age. So if you guys have any recommendations, I would really appreciate it.
Terrific. Jennifer, do you have thoughts for Danny?
Oh my goodness, so many. I want to give Danny my email because I have so many recommendations. I have a preschooler too. I mean, we always enjoy the Berenstain Bears books, but there's so many that come to mind that I'm blanking on now. But you know what's fun is reading picture books about real topics like current events in the news. But of course, picture books are written geared towards children. So Edwige Danticat has a beautiful picture book called Mama's Nightingale. And it's about a little girl who writes letters to the newspaper trying to get her mother released from a deportation center in Florida. Her parents are from Haiti. And these are big topics, but they're told in these beautiful stories that are under 800 words. And yet there are opportunities to talk with your kids about these real life issues.
So what we can also try to do is see if we can get contact information for Dani. Maybe you can give us a list, Jennifer, and we can send it on to her offline as well. Rachel, how about you? And both sort of preschool books, but also chapter books that families can read out loud together.
Yeah, my son is six, so we've done a whole lot of reading together this year, especially being home together so much. We have really loved the whole Princess in Black series by Shannon Hale. He's read all of those a million times, or at least it feels that way. They're so much fun. He's also really enjoyed the Ricky Ricotta books this year, which is about a mouse named Ricky Ricotta and his mighty robot. And those have also been a lot of fun, really fun read alouds. And he's just barely starting to read. So we've looked at some sort of early readers together, too. But those are two series that are great for us.
Okay, let's grab one more call here. I think we've got time for Mitch in Jamaica Plain. Mitch, go ahead briefly.
Yes, I read biography of George Orwell, so I'm rereading 1984 because of what's happening in Western China, among other places. And for the kids, take along Animal Farm. And the other one is a classic, which is Amos Oz, A Tale of Love and Darkness. And it explains so much about the soul of Israel.
Amos Oz, The Tale of Love and Darkness. All right. Thanks for those recommendations, Mitch. Okay. With our little bit of time left, just one more that you can't bear not to recommend briefly, Jennifer. Go ahead.
Oh, my goodness. What We Carry by Maya Lang. It is so gripping. It's a memoir. It's a story about her journey being a mother, a young mother, and her own mother's experience with Alzheimer's. And the way Maya writes is gorgeous. It's like your friend is telling you a story. And with each juicy bit, it makes you rethink everything she told you prior to that. So every chapter that I'm reading, it's changing the entire narrative. And it's a quick read too. I think that people can read it in a weekend and you'll feel, you know, like that satisfied feeling after a good story.
Awesome. And Rachel, in just a couple sentences, one more from you.
Yeah, a book that I actually just started reading is Crying in H Mart by Michelle Zauner of Japanese Breakfast. It's a memoir about her mother passing away and sort of her trying to remember her mother, particularly through the food that they made together and that they ate together. Her mother is Korean and her father is American, and sort of hanging on to her Korean identity through the food and through her memories of her mother and the food. And I've only just started it and I'm reading it slowly because it's so beautiful, but it's really lovely. All right. And very moving.
What a reading feast. That's Rachel Cass, head buyer for the Harvard Bookstore in Cambridge, and author Jennifer De Leon, editor of Wise Latinas. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And listeners, thanks for calling in. You had some great book recommendations there. I no longer am worried about my binge for my vacation. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening today. And join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.